Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog on Wednesday urged restraint in Ukraine amid serious concerns that the escalating conflict could compromise atomic facilities there. The safety and security of nuclear facilities and nuclear and other radioactive material in Ukraine must under no circumstances be endangered, said Rafael Grossi, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA. Any such incident could have severe human and environmental consequences and also be a violation of the principles of the UN Charter, Mr. Grossi added. Ukraine has a large and established nuclear program, which also includes the site of the 1986 accident at the Chernobyl plant, which is believed to now be under the control of Russian forces. The brave people who operate, regulate, inspect and assess the nuclear facilities in Ukraine must be allowed to continue to do their indispensable job safely, unimpeded and without undue pressure, the IAEA chief insisted. On day 7 of the Ukraine crisis, UN-led efforts to ramp up support to the country's embattled health workers have continued, with the first shipment of life-saving supplies due to arrive in Poland in the coming hours. Initial concerns about a lack of medicines to treat chronic conditions such as diabetes have given way to an alert that people will die if they do not get oxygen and other supplies for emergency care, said Dr. Mike Ryan, head of the World Health Organization's Emergencies Program.
You know, some of us have been in this game a long time and we've developed very thick skins. But when you see nurses mechanically ventilating infants in basements of hospitals, you know, even the toughest of us, we struggle to watch that.
Head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said that 36 tons of materials for trauma care and emergency surgery were on their way from a WHO hub in Dubai, enough to meet the needs of 1,000 patients. Additional health supplies will also be available for another 150,000 people, the WHO Director General added. Prior to the conflict, the UN Health Agency had already distributed emergency supplies to 23 hospitals, but Tedros cautioned that these supplies in Kyiv were currently inaccessible. To Africa, where the UN Health Agency warned on Wednesday that 1 in 5 adults and 1 in 10 children and teenagers will likely be obese by the end of next year in 10 African countries unless robust action is taken. In some of the African nations under review, WHO showed that obesity levels reached 31% in adults and more than 16% amongst youngsters. Dr. Machidiso Mweti, WHO Regional Director for Africa, described the situation as a ticking time bomb, which if unchecked could cut millions of people's lives short. Being overweight is associated with severe disease and hospitalization from COVID-19, WHO said, but it added that many of the causes of obesity and being overweight were preventable and reversible. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with professor and historian Alfred McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change.
It takes a giant in the world of historians to write a book like this. His interview is really extraordinary.
We then speak with Professor Henry Giroux, who speaks about the growing fascism in America.
But he doesn't think we're past the point of no return.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Today we speak with University of Wisconsin history professor Alfred McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. The United States of America has been governing the globe now for 80 years, since World War II. This is about to end. By 2030, China will have the world's largest economy and hold more in riches than the U.S., which is deeply in debt. The America we knew will change drastically as a world power, just as the previous world powers, the British, and before them the Dutch, and before them the Spanish and the Portuguese, all saw their empires end. Climate change will upend the world. It already has started. The effects of climate change on the population of the world, especially China, will be catastrophic. The great coastal city of Shanghai, where 18 million people reside, will sink. Millions of the 400 million Chinese people in the North China Plain will be forced to evacuate. What can we learn from the demise of the great world powers in the past? Where is the United States headed, and how soon? What might be done to ameliorate this dire future? Only a prodigious historian would undertake to answer these questions. Our guest today is such an historian. Alfred W. McCoy holds the Fred Harvey Harrington Chair of History at the University of Wisconsin. He has written 20 books, including The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, for which he became well known, and recently In the Shadows of the American Century. We welcome Professor Al McCoy back to Law and Disorder to talk with us about the important new book, To Govern the Globe. Al McCoy, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael and Marjorie. Pleased to be here.
Al, we owe your magnificent book to a fall you took on the ice on one of those terrible Wisconsin winter days. I've got a picture in my head of you sitting on a chair at a table with your leg extended in a cast, working 18 hours a day, every day for a year on that manuscript. Was that what it was like?
Well, that's pretty accurate. First of all, it wasn't a cast because it wasn't a bone break. I just shredded three tendons in the knee. So it was a mechanical brace, and it was not 12 months, but 5 months. But for 5 months, I was confined to a chair. I couldn't really walk. I couldn't drive. I couldn't get on an airplane. Fortunately, I was on sabbatical. So I just really, and also because of the leg brace, I couldn't really sleep more than about 5 hours a night. So basically, I just sat in that chair for 5 months, with great stacks of books and articles and the internet, and by the time the brace came off in summer, I had the first draft of a book. And then it took me another year of cleaning it up and also realizing what I was trying to say.
That's great, Al. The United States has been a major world power for the last 80 years since World War II. It's a world power in the economic, military, and political spheres. Can you please talk about this?
Sure. At the end of World War II, in the midst of this cataclysm that left over 70 million people dead and cities destroyed on several continents, the United States emerged as the most powerful empire that had ever existed, the most powerful empire in human history. And we use that power to do two things. One, to establish our hegemony and dominance the globe beyond the Soviet bloc and then the Sino-Soviet bloc. And second, what we did was we used that power in concert with allies and in dialogue with civil society groups, and that dialogue with civil society groups was tremendously important, to build a world order. That it was in many ways the culmination of the struggle for human rights over the past five centuries. And that world order, which was enshrined in the UN and a whole succession of like international organizations, was founded on two basic principles. One, all human beings had universal human rights, and all human communities had the right to live in a sovereign state, and that sovereign state had inviolable sovereignty. And like all world orders in the past, this world order had a duality between power and principle, and that power was exercised by the world's most enormously powerful military and also by a very new method of projecting power, the CIA and covert projection of power. And so there was a yawning contradiction in that system. One, the United States had built this liberal international order where every nation had inviolable sovereignty, and yet the United States was a great global hegemon, and in the asymmetric nature of the power, the United States necessarily had to violate that sovereignty. So how could the United States break its own rules? Well, the only way to do it was to do it covertly. And so in 1947, we established the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, and it was originally supposed to be an intelligence organization, but it very quickly transformed into a covert apparatus for intervening overseas, for intervening when we couldn't be seen to intervene, in other words, to do it covertly. And it was the CIA that gained enormous power because it mediated that fundamental contradiction in the U.S. world order.
We're speaking with historian Al McCoy about his new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. Al, in the past 700 years, there have been other world powers, the Iberian power of the Spanish and the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the British. What lessons can we learn from their rise and decline?
Yeah, really from the 16th century right to the present, there has been, as you just said, Michael, this amazingly diverse array of dominant world powers, all the way from rather small, lightly populated Portugal to the United States, which is a major continental power. But through this succession, there has been one absolute constant. The rise of every nation to global power has been coincident with its dominance over the vast Eurasian landmass. And the decline of that same power has coincided with its loss of control over that same Eurasian landmass. And so it is with the United States. You know, at the end of World War II, when we had that enormous power that we've just been talking about, the United States became, as a British historian named John Darwin has argued, the first power in 1,000 years to control both axial ends of Eurasia. And how do we do this? Well, at the start of the Cold War in the late 1940s, the United States formed a NATO alliance, and we built massive bases like Ramstein Air Base in Germany, and that gave us a secure anchor at the western axial end of Eurasia. And then on October 1st, 1949, when Mao Zedong stood up in Beijing at Tiananmen Square and announced the formation of the People's Republic of China, and then within months forged an alliance with the Soviet Union, creating the Sino-Soviet bloc, an alliance between Stalin and Mao, suddenly the United States realized that containing communism wasn't just a matter of Europe, it was global. And so the United States very quickly in 1951 and then 1953 signed 4 mutual security pacts with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia, giving us this Pacific littoral, a line of massive military bases stretching from Japan through the Philippines all the way down to Australia. We didn't have actual bases in Australia, but the Australians had their own. And this Pacific littoral, which the Chinese call the first island chain, became the fulcrum for U.S. geopolitical power, the fulcrum for the defense of one continent, North America, and the projection of power to dominate another continent, Eurasia. And then the United States ringed those 2 axial points, those 2 anchors of bases at the west and east of Eurasia, with successive chains of steel. First of all, mutual defense pacts stretching from NATO in Europe to CETO in Southeast Asia and ANZUS with Australia and New Zealand. Next, 2 powerful fleets, the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean Atlantic, the 7th Fleet in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, and then we added later on the 5th Fleet in the Persian Gulf, and then hundreds of military bases, thousands of bombers and missiles, and we ringed Eurasia with these powerful chains of steel, and we contained the Sino-Soviet bloc behind that iron curtain, and that was the key to our success in the Cold War. We could simply sit back and wait for our rivals to make mistakes or not, as the case turned out. And, you know, that the breaking of those chains are what the world is witnessing today in Ukraine and in the South China Sea.
Al, as the Spaniards slaughtered the native populations in the Caribbean and Mexico, there was internal opposition. I'm thinking specifically of the Dominican priest Bartolome de las Casas, and also the Quaker and Methodist opposition to the British slave trade. Can you discuss that, please?
Sure. First of all, I said, you know, at the beginning, every world order has a duality between power manifest in empire and principle, which is articulated by civil society activists, most often people that have profound principles, and historically these are religious principles. Bartolome de las Casas was not only a critic of Spanish imperial conquest, he participated in the conquest of Cuba, and he, as he describes in his short history, his famous short history, his most translated and read work, he was in Cuba, and he describes, for example, that he said the natives laid before us a feast, and we sat down and to enjoy that feast, and then we slaughtered 300 of them. And he describes this succession of massacres that, in some, destroyed the indigenous population of the Caribbean, the Tainos and the Arawak, who only remain, survive today, in the genes of the peoples of the Caribbean. They've basically been extinguished. And De Las Casas had a, reading the Bible, had a blinding moment of spiritual insight and devoted the rest of his life to not only exposing these great crimes, but trying to stop them. And he started, at the very end of his life, he came to a realization. First of all, he wanted the Spanish to stop enslaving and slaughtering the Amerindians. So for a while, he actually suggested the African slave trade might be an alternative. Then he realized that this was a great crime. And in his last writings, he recognized that he had made a terrible mistake, because what he realized is that everybody, pagan and Christian alike, we're all humans, and we all have human rights. And that realization of fundamental humanity came right at the start of this process. And that unleashed a kind of dialogue that other Dominicans, like Francisco de Vitoria, who was a lecturer in law at a Spanish university, he gave very famous lectures that were recorded and published. And that inspired Hugo Grotius, the great Dutch legal scholar, who's often considered the architect of international law and the modern international system. And that dialogue extended to the United Kingdom, where, again, the so-called dissenting churches, the Quakers, the Methodists, and evangelical Anglicans, decided that in the late 18th century, when Britain's empire, as major activity, was the Middle Passage, over half the slaves carried across the Atlantic in the latter decades of the 18th century, which is the peak of the slave trade, were carried on British ships. And the profits from the sale of the slaves, the work on the British West Indies plantations, all of that produced enormous wealth for Great Britain. So at this peak of British imperial power, these dissenting churches launched this massive campaign, an island nation of 10 million people in Britain. They got a petition with 1 million signatures, and in 1807, the British Parliament announced, they passed legislation abolishing the slave trade. And at the settlement of the Napoleonic Wars in the Congress of Vienna, Article 15 in the treaty, which most people don't read, not aware of, is this ringing denunciation of the slave trade, calling on all the nations of the world to abolish it. And as soon as the Napoleonic Wars were over, the British Navy, the Royal Navy, the most powerful military force on the planet, spent the next 70 and 80 years with its prime military mission, the abolition of the slave trade. They lost 15,000 sailors in that fight, and spent about 2% of their gross domestic product, and they succeeded in abolishing the slave trade. Of course, there's always that other side of the duality. That's principle, created by those civil society groups, enshrined in law and enforced by naval power. But then there was the other realpolitik side of British imperial power, and they conquered colonies and introduced forced labor, unpaid forced labor, in the European colonies in the imperial age from the 1880s to the 1930s. Ordinary people, adult males, all adult males had to work between 16 and 20 days a year of free labor building imperial infrastructure. So it was a halfway station on the path to human rights. And then at San Francisco in 1945, again, as the Americans were, at the end of World War II, Europe was in ruins, the British Empire was in decline, although they hadn't realized it yet. It was all over for imperialism. And at this moment, when the United States was setting up this current international order, the first conference to form the UN was near Washington, D.C. at Dumbarton Oaks, and it was kind of a closed-door imperial club, and they agreed that the Security Council would be all-powerful, and as Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, they would have an assembly so that the little countries could get together once a year and blow off steam. Okay, so it was supposed to be a closed imperial club. And then they took that to San Francisco, where all kinds of delegations turned up from American religious groups, Jewish groups, the NAACP, labor unions. There was Latin American delegates had a kind of pre-UN conference, and they came with their principles. And the United Nations, the more open, equitable organization that we have today, was transformed by that civil society input. So civil society is of paramount importance in articulating and propagating these principles that temper the ruthlessness of empire.
We're speaking with Al McCoy, who's originally written To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. Al, you write that the United States will be eclipsed by China by the year 2030.
How so?
Sure. First of all, it's not just me that's been saying this. The U.S. National Intelligence Council, which is the supreme analytic body of the U.S. intelligence community, every 4 years writes a predictive report. And back in 2012, I think it was, they issued their report, and they said that by 2030, if not before, China's economy will be larger than the U.S. economy. And he said that they were witnessing an historic shift of power. In the 18th century, power moved from Asia to Europe, and now it's moving from west to east. And in terms of global power, economic strength, they said we can predict that Asia will be more powerful than the United States by 2030. And the international accounting firm, PricewaterhouseCoopers, known as PwC, predicted that by 2030, in terms of real purchasing power, China's economy will be 60% larger than the U.S. economy. Now, since over the long term, the United States and China spend roughly 2 and about 3% of their gross domestic product on defense and defense procurements. If China's economy is 60% larger, they're going to be spending more, and they have a very lively and growing defense military establishment. And they are no longer a near peer competitor. They're a peer competitor, and they're now moving, I think, beyond parity. Just take late last year, the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff said that he had a near Sputnik moment because China had successfully tested a hypersonic missile. Now, that's a missile that flies at least 4,000 miles an hour. The United States has been trying to develop hypersonic missiles, and every test we've had has basically burned up because they're flying so fast. So it's an enormously technologically challenged issue. China's done it. And that means they have a missile that can penetrate any possible continental U.S. air defenses. In other words, they can strike, they can launch a nuclear strike on any American city, and we can't stop them. And more importantly, that means they can knock any American aircraft carrier out of the water about anywhere in the Pacific, particularly close to China itself, where they have more conventional missiles called carrier killer missiles that are already capable of taking out an American aircraft carrier. So when your military establishment knows that if it comes to war, we lose, that tempers your foreign policy. That means you give way to the dominant superior power. And that is just now starting to happen.
Al, how does the accelerating climate change catastrophe figure into all of this? For example, the huge coastal city of Shanghai going underwater, or people on the plains of China dying of heat stroke, and the massive population migrations that would ensue.
Sure. First of all, prediction is enormously difficult. My own discipline, history, when we try and track the past and the future, we usually get it wrong, and not only wrong, but almost laughably so. Economics and political science don't like even medium-term predictions. They don't like to go much beyond the next election or maybe the next recession. But environmental science is different. The whole logic of environmental science is developing tools of observation, like ice cores, pulling ice cores out of Antarctica and Greenland and analyzing them. And then making projections all the way to the end of the century, grounded in computer modeling, natural science research, bringing all these diverse tools together into this very powerful science of environmental prediction. So what I did in my book was very simple. I simply took those environmental trajectories, I read the science, which is published in journals like Nature Communications, peer-reviewed, very solid, and I read the UN reports, and I simply overlaid on top of that likely changes in the political order that might be caused by this change. Okay, so if let's assume that the United States is a waning imperial power and China is on the ascent, and somewhere around 2030, China begins to build an alternative world order, okay? So how long is their world order going to last? My sense is if you look at the environmental science, they've only got about 2 or 3 decades on top, which is not long for an empire. Not long for a world order. Why? Well, first of all, by 2050, and the environmental science is very clear on this, sea levels will be rising, and Shanghai is arguably the most vulnerable city in the world to sea level rise, except perhaps maybe Miami. But it's very similar. It's not up a river like London. It's not protected by something like the Verrazano Narrows in New York, where you can put up a sea gate. You know, it's a coastal city, and it was dredged from swamp and sea starting in the 15th century. And the environmental science is very clear. By 2050, most of Shanghai is underwater. And that means a city of 18 million people and the economic engine for much of the Chinese economy is going to basically be underwater. The next thing is it's not just global warming, it's global heating. And a professor at MIT has published an article in Nature Communications, and he said that by 2070, there will be hundreds of extreme weather events in the North China Plain, which will become, he says, one of the least habitable places on the planet. Now, the North China Plain is currently home to 400 million people. It's the agricultural, in many ways, the demographic heartland of China. 400 million people is 30% of China's total population. And those, not only will there be hundreds of extreme weather events, but there are going to be at least five events in which there will be 35 degrees centigrade wet bulb temperature. Now, what does all that mean? That means that in the balance of heat and humidity, at that point, 35 degrees, the human body can't sweat. And so all of us, you, me, and Michael, sitting here, we'd be dead in 6 hours at rest under 35-degree wet bulb temperature. And there will be five protracted incidents of that lethal, fatal climate. Well, as China recoils from the damage to its coastal cities and the successive heat waves hitting its agricultural heartland, diminished crops, dislocations of population, it's going to have to pull back from the world and begin to address serious domestic issues. And worldwide, there are now 200 million people will be uprooted by climate change by 2050. There are now other projections from other groups that say it's as high as 1.2 billion people will be climate change refugees by 2050. The existing world order is absolutely incapable of handling that kind of movement. You know, think back. Between 2016 and 2018, we had Middle Easterners coming into the Greek islands into Europe, the sub-Saharan Africans crossing the Sahel, the Sahara Desert, and crossing the Mediterranean. We had Central Americans and some Mexicans, but mainly Central Americans, gathering at the U.S. border and trying to cross. And this was a shock to the international order that produced this rise of ultra-nationalist right-wing groups across the world. It led to Britain leaving the European Union. When you add up those Middle Eastern, African, and Central American refugees, that's only 2 million people in total were a shock to the current world order. And so by 2050, when you're talking about 200 million or 1.2 billion climate change refugees, the current international system is simply incapable of handling it, and it will crumble and collapse under that kind of pressure. So around 2050, we'll be without a global hegemon, we'll be without a world order, we'll be facing a world disorder, and we need to think about alternatives.
How do you see the Russian invasion of Ukraine following the expansion of the U.S.-controlled military alliance NATO up to the border of Russia and the U.S.-sponsored 2014 coup in the Ukraine as being a fight to control what you talk about, controlling the Eurasian landmass?
Sure. You recall earlier I said that the geopolitical basis for U.S. global power has been since the late 1940s, for the better part of 75 years, has rested upon the military dominance and the over Eurasia, initially containing the Sino-Soviet bloc behind the Iron Curtain, but even in the aftermath of Cold War, maintaining that apparatus of control to dominate this. Because, as I said, every world power, every global hegemon since the 16th century has dominated Eurasia. Eurasia is home to 70% of the world's population and productivity. In order to be a world power, you have to dominate Eurasia. So what we're looking at is something we haven't seen since the Stalin-Mao alliance, which lasted actually very briefly from 1950 to 1953. And very quickly, those two powers split. So it's really been about 60 years that we haven't seen an alliance between the two major powers on the Eurasian landmass. Putin and Xi Jinping are allied, and they're allied in a very similar strategy of trying to mount pressure to snap those chains of steel that the United States laid around the Eurasian landmass. And this means Eurasia has been a kind of ring of fire, and if you connect the dots, the geopolitical dots around the continent, what you see is the pressure in Ukraine, the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan, which China made possible by ringing Afghanistan with a geopolitical change that basically isolated the United States. There are military maneuvers in the Himalayas with the Indian Army mobilizing troops to check China. There's the Quad, the alliance between Japan, Australia, the United States, and India conducting the Malabar live-firing naval exercise in the Bay of Bengal. There's China swarming its aircraft in the Taiwan Strait. It's a joint Russian-Chinese fleet that late last year just steamed around all of Japan, formerly U.S. waters. And then there are maneuvers in the Arctic, joint maneuvers by China and Russia. And so basically what's happened is that China and Russia together are mounting this campaign of tension, this campaign of pressure to slowly snap those chains of steel, push the United States off the Eurasian landmass, drive wedges in the NATO alliance, weaken the bilateral ties between those four powers, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, and the United States, and thus take control of the Eurasian landmass and emerge as the dominant powers in the world. And that's what we're witnessing. It's an epical change. So that economic decline of the relative decline of the United States, China's ascent economically, China's ascent militarily, it also has a geopolitical dimension, and we will see a succession of like events going on all around this ring of fire, around this the 6,000 miles of the Eurasian landmass, for till the end of the decade, by which time U.S. global power will be over, and then we'll see a new form of dominance in Eurasia and the rise of a new global power.
Well, thank you, Al McCoy. We've run out of our allotted time. This is a good point to end, and we recommend heartily that our listeners read your new book, To Govern the Globe, World Orders and Catastrophic Change. It's available from Haymarket Books. Thank you very much, Al, for your time today and for your good work over the many years. We wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you, guys, and very much, everybody, for having me on the show, okay?
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
An American form of fascism is unfolding in our country. What exactly it is and what we can do to fight it is the question of the day. We see a massive political effort to legitimize and normalize white minority rule. Things are happening rapidly. Just a year ago, our Capitol was attacked pursuant to a plan to reverse the results of a presidential election. Soon, the Supreme Court will likely overrule the almost 50-year-old precedent set in the Roe v. Wade case on the question of a woman's right to control her own body. Voting rights have been and will continue to be extremely restricted, particularly in communities of color. Irrational and magical thinking has been legitimized. Over 900,000 people have unnecessarily died of COVID. There has developed in our country a culture of cruelty manifested by Trump, but initiated in CIA torture and detention camps for Muslim men and boys in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. It didn't start after 9/11 with the wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. It goes back further than that. America has been prosecuting wars abroad during our entire lifetimes. The provocations against Russia regarding NATO military encroachment on its borders are the latest chapter in almost continual and seemingly endless wars. A lesson of history since Greek and Roman times is that if you can't have imperialism abroad and democracy at home, well, you certainly can't do them both at the same time. We speak today with Professor Henry Giroux, who currently holds the McMaster University Chair for a scholarship in the public interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department. He has written many books, most recently, The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and also the book American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely, our pleasure. Now, you write that there's no single version of fascism. Well, how would you characterize, then, the developing fascism in America and distinguish it, perhaps, from fascism as it developed in Germany or Italy or Spain?
No, I don't think that fascism is simply of one piece, but I do think there are certain principles that get updated and take on a particular form endemic to the country in which they're being produced, and I think there are a series of warning signs, particularly in the United States and in some cases across the globe. And one is the ultra-nationalism that we see everywhere now. The other is the emergence of white supremacy as a legitimate discourse. The other is that we see what I would call the claim that America is in decline. You see the elevation of instinct over emotion. You see the attempt to suppress dissent. You see the attempt at contempt for weakness, the hypermasculinity, the culture of fear. I think the anti-intellectualism. I think what I call the politics of disposability and the claims of racial purity that we see. Also the emphasis on censorship, the rewriting of history in a way that seems to suggest that white nationalism is the only way that people can occupy, the only discourse available for people to occupy the public sphere. I think all of those issues basically represent a rebranded form of fascism that emerges through a particular lens of American culture that has now given us a warning sign about, you know, how they fundamentally echo the past.
Henry, you've written that, quote, the lines between democracy and authoritarianism are collapsing, close quote. How can you demonstrate this?
Well, I'll tell you, one way to look at it is to look at the recent report from the Economist Intelligence Unit, which talks about the rise of the suppression of dissent in the United States, the collapse between the truth and misinformation, the cult of the strong man, the lies, the attack on civic culture, and of course, the increasing, and more than anything, the increasing use of violence as a political form to basically threaten, institute a culture of fear, and to appropriate and engage in the struggle for political power. I mean, the January 6th revolt, it seems, or insurrection, it seems to me, is a classic example of what I would call a counter-revolution. I mean, it's a counter-revolution going on in the United States. You know, it's an attempt to undo democracy, undo the Constitution, undo the rule of law in multiple ways. I mean, when you get a former president of the United States promising, when you get a president of the United States during his term, you know, or offering pardons to criminals, I mean, claiming that treating the Justice Department as if it's its own personal lawyer, you know, trying to negotiate ways in which he could overturn the election, and then getting a Republican Party that absolutely endorses all of that stuff and believes in the big lie and goes so far as to claim that the insurrection itself was nothing more than an expression of legitimate political discourse. I think it's pretty clear that democracy is under siege, not to mention what he's done with the Supreme Court, which really seems to be now captured by a bunch of conservative thugs who have no understanding of what it means to take seriously the promise and the ideals of democracy, particularly around both voting rights and the reproductive assault on women's bodies. So I think, yeah, we can say that those institutions, those principles, those ideas,
that are meaningful in a democracy are beginning to collapse. Civic culture is collapsing in the United States. You know, civic culture is basically something supported by what I call a democratic formative culture, in which questions of community, justice, fairness, compassion, understanding, respect for the welfare state, respect for unions, respect for counter-opinions are really operative. And I think increasingly what we see is a war on all of those things. And they're not hard to discern. And I think in that sense, yes, democracy is on the decline in the United States, just as the Economist report pointed out a few weeks ago. It actually downplayed the United States from what it called a full democracy to a flawed democracy.
Yes, as have other organizations in the world which rate and qualify how high or how low on the democracy scale nations are. Now, Henry, also, I wonder, we hear this word, you know, the term neoliberalism thrown around rather freely in this country. What is neoliberalism, and what role do you think it's been playing in preparing the ground for the seeds?
Neoliberalism is the most pernicious philosophy that has come along since the divine right of kings. And it basically emerged in the 1970s under Carter, but when Ronald Reagan married Margaret Thatcher, it became basically, and with the fall, of course, of the Berlin Wall, it became a full-fledged ideology that seemed to suggest that the only thing that really matters is the market, and that the market is not just an economy that concentrates wealth and power in the hands of few people, is a template for not only basically regulating the market, but regulating all of social life. And so it seems to me that what neoliberalism has done is that a number of things. It seems to suggest that the only thing that matters is unchecked individualism, harsh competition. It replaces the notion of the public good and all forms of solidarity with a kind of Benthian war of all against all. It puts a premium on competitive attitudes, degrades collaboration. It claims that markets should regulate themselves. It's absolutely wedded to a form of economic Darwinism in which privatization, commodification, deregulation are the mantras of how the market should work. And it privatizes everything. And I think that what we have seen under neoliberalism are two things. We've seen the increasing concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a financial elite. We've seen the emergence of massive inequality that is really a killing machine. We've also seen basically a pedagogy, an educational thrust that seems to suggest something very deadly, that all the problems that we face are individual problems, and that private troubles are basically just that. So any problems that we face, we have to face alone. That has produced a massive form of alienation, depoliticization, and it does something tragic to a democracy. It operates off the assumption that people can no longer translate private issues into larger social considerations, so they have no understanding of systemic problems and how they work.
Henry, you see our culture is shifting. Lenin once remarked on this phenomena. He said something to the effect that nothing happens for decades, then all of a sudden decades seem to happen in a few days. Would you share that observation?
Yeah, I guess when Ronald Reagan made the declaration that government is really the problem and not the cure, something shifted. And what shifted was a discourse at the highest levels of power that now said that capitalism was unchecked and that it could do anything it wanted. And all of a sudden we saw an enormous assault on public goods, on unions, on schools. We saw a counter-revolution in the making, in which people were increasingly responding to the decades of democratization and protests that went on in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I think that we saw democracy in free fall, and it has never recovered, and it got worse. We saw the move from basically an investment in public goods to the rise of a financial elite in which money completely dictated politics. And so we saw a major collapse here around rights. While personal rights suffered and political rights, of course, suffered, voter suppression laws, as obvious, among other things, but social rights suffered, meaning that we now had a redefinition of freedom and justice and equality that were really their opposites. I mean, freedom meant the freedom to do anything you want. Justice meant don't address questions of injustice. Social responsibility meant, you know, by the neoliberal mantra that economic activity should be divorced from social cost. And what that meant is you no longer had to think about ethics anymore. So in that sense, there was a real shift in the culture, yes. And there was also an increasing shift in higher education and public education, which has always been a laboratory for democracy. I mean, you know and I know what happened after 1980. All of a sudden, the universities became corporatized. And all of a sudden, 70% of the faculty was no longer tenured. There was a massive assault on academic freedom. Many of them lost their jobs, lost their benefits, and it no longer became a center of, in my estimation, of struggle. The great public intellectuals today are not academics, they're journalists. And I think that, you know, we lost that critical culture that was so central to the 60s and the 80s, along with the institutions that informed it.
Now, I wonder, Henry, too, would you agree that we've been witnessing in recent times a massively increasing political effort to, well, legitimize and normalize white majority rule?
I think that's a fabulous question. I really do. And I can't tell you how much how important that is. Yes, but I'm going to just qualify that a bit. It's not white minority rule. It's white supremacist rule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's be honest here. You know, this is really about keeping people of color, brown people, black people, out of the democratic process. And it's done in ways that uses the language of white supremacy, white nationalism, and outright and overt racism. We've seen it with Trump. We see it with the Republican Party. We see it with policies that are... Can you imagine? You and I now live in... the United States is now a country that says that school teachers, if they talk about slavery... Or if they talk about injustices in the past, they could be fired, fined, or who knows, punished in, by viewing such behavior as criminal behavior. Does that remind you of something? Do you have to be a rocket scientist to not recognize that we saw the same thing in the 1930s in Germany? You know, when all of a sudden certain forms of knowledge were considered debased and corrupted and they burned books in the name of racial purity? I mean, this is white supremacy unadulterated. There's no other way to talk about that. It's not simply white minority rule. It's white minority rule in the interest of racial cleansing. First you burn books, then you ban intellectuals, then you burn bodies.
Henry, please talk about the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, and then the attack on women's reproductive rights, the attack on voting rights, and the attack on racial justice.
They're all connected. And I think that what they're connected by, not the fact that they're expressions of a Republican majority sort of hating all of those things. They're connected because they're part of a counter-revolution. They're part of a counter-revolution that recognizes that wherever justice and freedom emerge in terms of a collective effort to deepen and expand the possibilities of democracy, it has to be shut down. And that's exactly what they're doing. This is a counter-revolution that believes in violence, not just violence in the way that we saw given the attack on the Capitol, which is an attempt to both legitimate Trump and the cult of leadership in that particular form of fascism. But it's also an attack on education. It's also an attack on women's bodies. It's also an attack on justice. It's an attack on all those areas in which people may have some control over their political, social, and political rights. And so I think in that sense, we're not just dealing with a minor insurrection. Oh, I'm sorry. We're not just dealing with an insurrection that's almost unthinkable in terms of what happened in an attempt to legitimate it. What we're dealing with is a full throttle, full-fledged attack on democracy. That's what we're dealing with. I mean, you know and I know. In the 70s, you know, you had the Powell Memo, you had the Trilateral Commission talking about the excess of democracy. That was a warning. They wanted to fight that battle in the realm of ideas, and they did. But with, of course, the Heritage Foundation and all kinds of conservative institutions emerging, Fox News, the social media. But this is different. This attack on democracy operates under the threat of force, under the threat of outright censorship, and under the threat of the language of white supremacy. To put it bluntly, you know, having studied critical theory all my life, you know, I think it was Horkheimer who once said, you want to study fascism, then you better look at capitalism quite carefully.
Well, following up on that, Henry, I want you to talk a bit about that in this context. I mean, you've got guys like Charles Koch and others, you know, funding the Republican Party, funding God knows how many other right-wing projects in the country. Talk to us a bit about the relationship between big business and the growth of fascism.
I think there are, thank you again for a great question. I think there are a couple of things. I think that with the financial crisis of 2009, something became obvious. And what became obvious was that neoliberalism failed. It failed on its promises. It was going to lift the boat. Everybody, you know, it was going to redistribute wealth. Everybody was going to be happy. Everybody would have jobs. You know, security would be somehow taken care of. We wouldn't have to worry about unions. You know, the private sector could operate more efficiently than the public sector. Well, this was all nonsense. And so since it couldn't defend itself any longer in terms of the promises that it had put forth, it turned to something else. It turned to fascism, a fascist politics in which it now blamed blacks. It now blamed immigrants. It now blamed Muslims. It now blamed the people who believed in the common good. And in doing that, it seems to me that it opened up for corporations and the financial elite, particularly those on the right. This doesn't include all corporations, and it doesn't include all of the corporate elite, but the hard right corporate elite, the Koch brothers. You know, people, Peter Thiel, you know, a whole range of these, Elon Musk, these are corporate thugs, you know, and they really believe that profit above all absolutely has to be sustained through a logic that says that the government should in no way interfere with what they do. This is Milton Friedman on steroids. That's what this is. But it's not Milton Friedman simply on steroids. It's the Milton Friedman who supported Pinochet. It's the Milton Friedman who believed that dictatorships provide more opportunities for corporations than democracies do. And that's what we're seeing now.
For our listeners who just tuned in, we're speaking with Professor Henry Giroux. Henry, do you think that we're past the point of no return? And if not, what good things do you see developing on our side?
I don't think we're ever past the point of no return. There was resistance even in the camps. I mean, I think there are a lot of hopeful signs. I mean, particularly among young people. I mean, I think that young people, teachers, are really mobilizing in a way that suggests that they no longer want to be written out of the script of democracy. And they're also realizing that in many ways they now inhabit a culture of such overt violence without apology that they can't fight this alone. And so, you know, we see young people, of course, protesting against violence, school violence. We see teachers walking out of schools because their roles have been diminished. You know, but I do, and of course, there's a women's rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, along with other black movements and brown movements. These are very powerful movements, and they offer enormous hope. The only thing is they suffer from two problems that have to be overcome. And one is they really need to stop being fractionalized and unite in a mass party that's able to be systemically organized to put pressure in ways that bring power to bear to stop this fascist politics that we're engulfed in. Secondly, they need to take education seriously. I mean, one of the things that we've learned from the convoy movement in Canada, increasingly now coming to the United States, is that social messaging matters. The media matters. It's a massive educational machine that can function in the interest of domination or the interest of liberation. I mean, it can change consciousness and it can destroy it. And I think in many ways, you know, those two issues have to come together. We need to bring people together in a mass movement, a mass social movement, uniting these different factions without denying the importance of the forms of oppression that they point to. And secondly, we need a massive educational movement that takes popular education seriously and really knows how to use the media to be able to speak to people in a language they understand and in which they can recognize themselves and in which they can rethink the conditions under which they find themselves.
I wonder too, Henry, certainly it would seem the Republican Party or great portions of it have endorsed and embraced the violence of January 6th. Violence is, as I think you've talked about and written about, endemic to fascism, is it not? Talk to us a bit about what you, I think, have called many signposts that give rise to this kind of violence and how it becomes normalized.
Well, I think it becomes normalized when it becomes repeated endlessly and treated as entertainment or just treated as news without any serious analysis of what causes it and what the underlying logics and forces are that, that produce it. I mean, violence is the DNA of American culture. It's everywhere. We're an increasingly militarized society, and I think that what, if you want to point to one central element that's caused it, it's very simple in my mind, and that is, as the social state declines, and we can't address social problems by getting at their roots and dealing with them in ways that address them, then we criminalize those problems. And when we start to criminalize those problems, criminalize poverty, homelessness, the kinds of problems that young people face in schools, you have a massive expansion of what I call the punishing state. This is called creeping punishment. And that creeping punishment is endemic to fascism. And it's endemic to supporting politics of terror and domestic terrorism, in which violence becomes the organizing principle by which we both organize society and use it to address the problems that we address. It's about the exhaustion of neoliberalism. It has no answers anymore. And so we have to resort to violence and increase the punishing state, the carceral state, in order to deal with this stuff. That's why you have, I mean, think about it. Last year, the police killed more people than they have in the last 10 years. I mean, over 1,000 people were killed by the police. I mean, you have a system out of control in terms of not having the social supports, not having a society that provides social provisions, not having a society that addresses massive, massive inequality. I mean, inequality is a killer. It's a form of necropolitics, and it's run rampant. It's unchecked right now in American society.
Do you believe the Democratic Party can be trusted to do a good job in defending us? Sheldon Wolin called the Democratic Party the inauthentic opposition. And right now, they've been supine. They refuse to mobilize the American people. What are your thoughts about that?
No, I think we have two parties. One party is basically the strong party of Wall Street, and the other party is the weak party of Wall Street. I mean, they're both wedded to Wall Street. I mean, they're centrist liberals who don't believe in the distribution of wealth, who don't believe that capitalism and democracy are not the same, who don't believe that in some fundamental way the system doesn't work. They want to put band-aids on the system. And then when they get attacked, like all liberals, you know, the definition of liberalism that I always love of liberals is that when a fight breaks out, they leave the room. You know, that was Obama, right? I mean, he left the room.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do more to please the right. They're more afraid of the right than they are the left. And it seems to me that that translates into something horrendous, because a centrist today in the United States, in Europe, would be on the far right. They wouldn't be called centrist; they'd be called the far right. I mean, Biden. What does he do? I mean, beyond his infrastructure bill, I mean, does he talk about free education? Does he talk about universal health care? Does he talk about redistributing wealth? He doesn't talk about any of these things. I mean, and he's going to be defeated in 2024, no question in my mind. He'll be defeated. The Democrats are too weak, they're not justified, and they have people in the party who basically are Republicans, who are Republicans in drag.
Henry, as we speak, there are, I don't know how many trucks, basically over the last couple of weeks, brought government more or less to a standstill in Canada. And now they're lined up in my old hometown, Detroit, at the Ambassador Bridge, stopping traffic now from going over there. They're talking about coming down to the Super Bowl, having a whole cross-country parade of trucks. So far, nobody's figured out how to stop them or what to do about it. How should we read this? How should we see this?
I think this is a counter-revolutionary movement that's taken the notion of freedom right out of the neoliberal handbook and so abused it that basically it's now attracted it's attracted white supremacists, neo-Nazis, you know, people who basically have no concern for the common good, anti-vaxxers, a lot of conspiracy theorist types. I think it needs to be named for what it is. They have a great social messaging system. They have the instruments to basically wage a massive strike, and they're doing it in the name of the abuse of freedom. I mean, this is a full-fledged, unadulterated attack on the common good. That's what it is. This isn't about freedom. This is about the death of democracy. And I think that what we see here is an inability of the mainstream and liberal press to really unpack this for what it is. This is not just about, you know, doing away with mass vaccinations. This is not just about repudiating public health officials. This is an attack on the on government responsibility. This is an attack on social justice, and this is an attack on the public good. That's what it is, and it's got to be named that way. I'm not sure how this is going to be resolved without engaging in massive without a massive violence occurring. But I'll tell you, it's far more frightening than the insurrection of January 6th, in my mind.
I agree.
It's far more frightening. It really is. It's a playbook now for the right, and they're going to engage this in every way they can to basically shut down this democracy, whatever's left of it. So I would say these are very dangerous times, and the convoy is symptomatic of that.
Thank you, Henry, for that. Sadly, I agree with you.
We've come to the end of our allotted time, Henry. I wanted to ask you if you could tell our audience how people can follow your work. It's Henry Giroux, G-I-R-O-U-X. Henry, how can people follow your work?
I have a website where I put all my work, and it's www.henryagiroux.com.
We hope you'll come back. We truly appreciated what you've had to teach us today. Thank you, Henry Giroux. You take it easy.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for the great questions.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Man, the working cages hit the town. He drinks his wages. You're a friend, you're a sweat. But did you know?
get at the 7-Eleven. Mark was sick, but he had faith in new linen, the necessary bed. What do we got? By the other team, went on to win 50-0. You can be true, you can be false, you'll be given the same reward. Socrates, a Milhouse, can vote with the same way through the kitchen. Plato the Greek, or in Tin Tin, who's more famous to the billion million? Boom, flash, vacuum cleaner sucks up budgie.
Coming up is from the Katie Halper show. That's H-A-L-P-E-R. Katie Halper. She's on a great show alone. Of course, it's on YouTube. Not on audio. But it aired yesterday, and it was with a guy who I follow, Chris Hedges. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. He used to write for the New York Times for almost a dozen years and got fired or asked to resign for his opposition to the last war of Iraq with Iraq, which no one in America seems to remember now that the neoliberal media is in a deep state of hysteria and hoping you are crazy, too. Pretty dangerous situation we're in. You know, this aired March 2nd, yesterday, on the Katie Halper Show with Chris Hedges, and it's 10 minutes long. I'll be back with you.
I'm going to bring on our first esteemed guest. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who for 15 years was a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, serving as the Middle East as well as the Balkan Bureau Chief. He previously worked overseas for the Dallas Morning News, the Christian Science Monitor, and NPR. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, Katie.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure.
You have a great recent piece that caused a little bit of a fight among my friends and families. My mom decided to text. She didn't do an email. She did like a mass text, a group text, and texted out your article. And so there were strong opinions, and we had to actually kill the chat because it was a little too hostile. But that's always a sign of a great writer. Great ideas, very provocative ideas. But you have a very sensible, I would say, piece that sadly you can't find this perspective most places. It's at Sheer Post, which is the website run by the great Bob Sheer. It's called Chronicle of a War Foretold. After the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a near universal understanding among political leaders that NATO expansion would be a foolish provocation against Russia. How naive we were to think that the military-industrial complex would allow such sanity to prevail. You write, I was in Eastern Europe in 1989 reporting on the revolutions that overthrew the ossified communist dictatorships that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was a time of hope. NATO, with the breakup of the Soviet Empire, became obsolete. President Mikhail Gorbachev reached out to Washington and Europe to build a new security pact that would include Russia. Secretary of State James Baker and the Reagan administration, along with the German foreign minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher, assured the Soviet leader that if Germany was unified, NATO would not be extended beyond the new borders. The commitment not to expand NATO, also made by Great Britain and France, appeared to herald a new global order. We saw the peace dividend dangled before us, the promise that the massive expenditures on weapons that characterized the Cold War would be converted into expenditures on social programs and infrastructures that have long been neglected to feed the insatiable appetite of the military. So my first question for you is, what happened?
The arms industry saw a multi-billion-dollar bonanza, which was converting the militaries in the former communist bloc to be NATO compatible. And that's what happened. Now, every politician and statesperson that I spoke with, I mean, I can't think of anyone who advocated the expansion of NATO. I mean, the tragedy was that Gorbachev, Yeltsin, and we forget in the early years of Putin, there was an attempt, a very serious attempt on the part of Russia to build a joint security pact. We can't forget the trauma that Russia endured in the Second World War when the Nazis invaded all the way to Moscow and devastated that whole swath of the Soviet Union. Of course, that was repeated a century earlier by Napoleon. They have legitimate fears of being encircled. And this was the Tehran Conference, the primary issue between Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill was carving up Eastern Europe in a way to protect the Soviet Union, to make it feel secure. And both the Americans and the British realized that as a necessity. This was also true in 1989. But unfortunately, that was completely abandoned and there were a series of agreements. So you had the agreement not to expand NATO beyond the borders of a unified Germany. Then the Clinton administration, and of course it did. There's now a missile base in Poland, 100 miles from the Russian border. Clinton then promised that he would not station NATO troops in Eastern Europe. We now have thousands of NATO troops in Eastern Europe. There was, the Minsk agreement that nobody ever honored. There was a promise not to intervene in the internal affairs of border countries like the Ukraine. It wasn't honored. So what has happened, of course, is preemptive war, which is under post-Nuremberg law as a criminal war of aggression. There's no way around it. And Russia is guilty, but they were baited and they took the bait and they pulled the trigger. And that's kind of the tragedy of what's happened.
So were you surprised?
So a lot of people were predicting that he wouldn't go beyond the separatist regions. I think he overreached. I think he should have stayed in the separatist regions. But I wasn't surprised for this reason. I spent 20 years covering war, and I'm well aware of information or disinformation as being a fundamental component to war. So for instance, in the first Gulf War, when I was with the Marine Corps on the border with Kuwait, there was a huge propaganda, a black kind of information campaign to make the Iraqis think that it would be a seaborne, a coastal invasion, and it worked. They played around with days, so the Iraqis were thrown off balance as to when it would happen. This is always true in war. And after the Nazis took Alsace Lorraine, they mounted these speakers and had a huge peace offensive. And so I didn't believe anything coming out of the Kremlin. Am I surprised that he did it? I'm surprised that he did it because I think it's really counterproductive. So on that, from a kind of strategic or tactical sense, yes. But I wasn't surprised that he was lying, because that's what every country on the inception of a war does.
You quote in your article, you quote a diplomatic
cable.
A cable that was obtained and released by WikiLeaks.
Right.
And it was dated February 1st, 2008, written from Moscow and addressed to the Joint Chiefs of Staff or NATO European Union Cooperative National Security Council, Russia Moscow Political Collective, Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of State. And you say that there was this understanding that expanding NATO risks an eventual conflict with Russia, especially over Ukraine.
Well, that's all in that cable. I mean, that was the general understanding. So I could have quoted George Kennan or all sorts of other people, but the cable is kind of interesting because they actually talk about how divisive NATO membership it would be to the Ukraine, what it would do to domestic politics, that it would create an opening for Russian intervention. This is 2008, that the Russian establishment would be encouraged to meddle in internal affairs in the Ukraine, and the U.S. would then meddle with opposing forces, and this would put, in their words, U.S. and Russia in a classic confrontational posture, and that's exactly where we are.
Right. It says in the memo, right, not only does Russia perceive encirclement by NATO and efforts to undermine Russia's influence in the region, but it also fears unpredictable and uncontrolled consequences, which would seriously affect Russian security interests. Experts tell us that Russia is particularly worried that the strong divisions in Ukraine over NATO membership with much of the ethnic Russian community against membership could lead to a major split involving violence or, at worst, civil war. And then you describe how it was for these reasons, right, among these reasons that Obama blocked arms sales to Ukraine.
Yeah, which was prudent and smart.
Right. And then, of course, reversed by Trump and then by Biden, because you had in this kind of unbelievable, but surely by now, I guess, believable and predictable move. But you saw these, you know, Democrats up in arms and accusing, you know, Trump of being a traitor because they wanted him to reverse Obama's position, which he ultimately did. And then so did Biden. I mean, why do you think Obama took that prudent decision
he understood that it was dumping gasoline on the conflict.
Right. But why do you think
because Biden failed at everything else. I mean, his presidency is a disaster. His opinion poll ratings are in the tank. His Build Back Better bill is gutted. All of his promises, like forgiving student loans and raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, have been forgotten. The moratorium on foreclosures, the extended child tax credit, all the assistance that people got is now being terminated. So what's better than a war? Now we got the EU just announced that they're going to allocate hundreds of millions of euros to buy weapons. Germany just said it would triple its defense budget. Biden has asked Congress for $6.4 billion for the Ukraine. And this is on top of the $650 million in military aid that they've given the Ukraine. It's absolute insanity, especially because Russia is a nuclear power, as Putin reminded everyone. These kind of merchants of death who are making tons of money off of this and made tons of money off of expanding NATO are at this point, I mean, over dramatic, but they're flirting with a nuclear holocaust. It's just nuts.
It is nuts. It is nuts. I mean, it's the kind of brinkmanship that I, my 23-year-old son asked me, he said, Dad, have you ever seen anything like this? And, you know, I was only 7 or 8, I think. I said, yeah, it was a long, long time. I was a kid. But it was traumatic enough that I remember. It was called the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was when we thought we were just minutes, if not an hour away of everybody dying in a nuclear war. And that was very traumatic for all the people, all of young people, at least my age, turned me into an avid scholar of communism and class struggle from that point on, and the Vietnam War ensuing after that, my life experience made me come to question completely the class system, economic class system as we live in today, and we continue to live all these years. The next one to come up, the next clip, I picked these clips because I think they're pertinent. I think that should set the tone of where we're at in the in this conflict. News reports have that the Russian army has closed in on several key cities. One is took the wise way out. The mayor of Mariupol, that's Mariupol, which is basically between Crimea and Odessa on the southern part of the map of Ukraine. Mariupol had the mayor and the city government surrendered, and they didn't surrender until there was reports of letting the water get cut, blown out, the heat and the electric power. Now that was stupid. They should have surrendered earlier. I mean, resistance is resistance, you know what I mean? You can do it. You don't have to have your place blown to smithereens before you surrender. But the mayor has done it. They've taken over the city administrative services building, the Russians have, that's reported. And the push in the south from the east, Russia, through Crimea, the Donbass area, is apparently having some success. and their speculation is that they want to go to Odessa, the large water Black Sea port. I don't know if they want to go that far or not. I don't care. That's being speculated. But they have taken Mariupol, which is right next to the Crimean corridor to Russia from the Black Sea. And what's interesting is the amount, as Hedges talks in that clip. Oh, by the way, that article, I want to be sure and get that to you. That article, you may have caught it and not and missed it. That article that Chris Hedges is talking about on the Katie Halper show yesterday morning or evening is from Sheer Post. That's S-C-H-E-E-R Post. That's the makeover of the Sheer website until Hedges and them had a strike, went on a writer's strike, and Sheer, the guy that runs it, Robert Sheer, of Rampart's magazine thing, he went along and they moved the whole writing staff over to another spot called Sheer Post. You can find it, and that's it. And Hedges is talking. I've been reading that article. It's a very interesting article. John Grant sent me an article by Hedges also. It's moving, that article. Now, coming up is a very interesting thing. Now, you may have heard Hedges talking about how the German government has promised to double, if not triple, the amount of their military and contribute more towards NATO. Now, this is very interesting because it's what's happening is that people are finding ways to skirt the NATO alliance in sending weapons to Ukraine. This is really interesting. Check it out.
Germany's Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock has backed calls to investigate potential human rights violations committed by Russia in Ukraine. She was speaking via video link to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva.
We urgently need a commission of inquiry on Ukraine to investigate all violations of human rights that have been committed by Russia since its military aggression. We must stand strong on accountability.
Meanwhile, Germany has announced that it's sending more weapons to Ukraine. A government source says Berlin has agreed to provide 2,700 anti-aircraft missiles. The weapons are Soviet-designed Strahler missiles from the stocks of the former East German armed forces. Germany had already committed to delivering 1,000 anti-tank weapons and 500 surface-to-air missiles. Berlin recently reversed a long-standing policy of not exporting weapons to conflict zones. Let's get some background on this from our chief political editor, Michaela Küchner. Michaela, these weapons are said to be of Soviet production from the former East German army. That's an irony of history, isn't it?
I think we're in the process of actually writing a new chapter in history. These are Soviet-made, yes. They were delivered to the former East Germany. These are weapons that were also used in Russia's conflict with Afghanistan back then in the days. So they're very old, but they are functioning hardware, and that is scarce currently in the German army. And after initially we heard the defense minister Lamprecht saying, look, we have to look what we even have, what we can give out. Well, this now is part of a continuing list because we do expect there to be more that can be given to Ukraine, always stressing that there's no direct handover. Germany is not delivering these weapons physically.
Does that make a difference for Russia? How is Russia viewing this? It's NATO weapons being used against them. I'm sure they're going to have something to say about it.
Well, these are specifically not weapons that are earmarked within NATO contingencies, and this actually is a key point. We heard the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia yesterday stressing that there's an increasing likelihood of misunderstandings of a direct contact between NATO and Russia, which fits into a Russian narrative of actually NATO being an active threat towards Russia, which NATO denies. It's a defense mechanism. And clearly, all NATO countries that are sending weapons are at pains to stress and to ensure that there is no direct contact, because that's what everybody wants to avoid, and that there would be a direct confrontation with Russia, which could, and, you know, I'm surprised I'm even saying this, but that is World War III scenario if that was to happen. So these are the stakes that are on the table at the moment.
Terrible stakes. The German government recently set up a special budget of 100 billion euros to ramp up defense, to modernize the German army, the Bundeswehr. And a fierce debate has now flared up in German politics about that. Can you bring us up to speed?
It's an internal debate. I mean, what we saw happening over the weekend is the Chancellor pretty much acting alone, turning around German defense and foreign policy of the past decades, and now effectively trebling the German defense budget overnight, which is quite something. I was with him as he traveled to Israel yesterday. There, that was received positively. Israel has now offered a new strategic dialogue. It so far only has with Britain and the US, and it shows that there's a new understanding of what strategic role Germany will have also in the future, and that it has to be able to defend itself because it's simply not able to do that. And this also fits in with the signals we're getting from the French President Emmanuel Macron, who's now stressing self-sufficiency is something that's needed in the future and an own strategic outlook. These are words we've heard before, but they're now being backed up by money, and it looks like infrastructure and hardware in the very near future as well.
Well, I think the money is the important sign. It always shows when people are serious. DW's chief political editor, Michaela Küchner, there for us. Thank you. And here are some more headlines related to this war. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, says his country will push on with its mission to, quote, demilitarize Ukraine and stop it joining NATO. Speaking on Russian television on Thursday, Lavrov accused Western countries of preparing for a war against Russia and raising the prospect of nuclear weapons. Police in Moscow have apparently detained a group of children for laying flowers at the Ukraine embassy. That's according to a social media user. Some were as young as 7. People were also arrested in St. Petersburg. A monitoring group says more than 8,000 anti-war protesters have now been detained in the past week in Russia. The International Paralympic Committee has banned Russian and Belarusian athletes from competing at the Paralympics. That reverses a previous decision just the day before the Games begin in Beijing. On Tuesday, the IPC had said athletes from the two countries could take part as neutrals. German carmaker Volkswagen says it will stop exports to Russia and halt producing vehicles there. It joins several other car companies now boycotting Russia over Ukraine. Some of the world's biggest technology companies, clothing brands, and industrial giants have now cut all ties with Russia, while various shipping companies have stopped deliveries.
That's how stupid the Germans have become, and how stupid most Americans are, and how stupid most Europeans have become over war and the proclivity, or I guess the underestimated danger, of igniting even a limited exchange of nuclear weapons. Tactical weapons. This is a really bad thing. Okay, now we won't be able to play it all. We'll be able to play almost all of it except the last remaining 2 minutes of the question and answer. This is from, of all places, the Oxford Union, Student Union in Oxford yesterday, and it features Sir Robert John Sawyer, S-A-W-E-R. He is, Sir Robert John Sawyer is the former head of a representative of the United Kingdom at the UN from August 2007 to November 2009, and chief of MI6, which is the Special Investigative Section of Special Intelligence Section. He was the chief of MI6 from November 2009 to November 2014, and he gives you he was for the intervention of Britain into Syria. So here we go, and we'll close out the program. I think you'll find it very interesting, the perspective of a neoliberal, high-level official who has been involved intimately with Russia and war.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's my first opportunity to come to the Oxford Union, so it's a great pleasure to be here, and rather difficult and dangerous times, so I understand why people have come out on a wet Monday night.
Well, we're speaking, as you say, at a particularly tense time in global politics. As we watch the war in Ukraine progress, is there anything that you feel the general public should be paying attention to that we're not?
Well, I certainly am glued to the news and following what is happening in Ukraine. And it is a terrible series of events that we're witnessing. The intelligence machinery, my service, MI6, predicted that this would happen. I was hoping it wouldn't in the end happen because I didn't think it was in President Putin's interest or Russia's interest, and I think he would have a sufficient assessment of where Russia's long-term interests lie not to do this. But I think one of the worrying features of this is that the cold, calculating President Putin that I watched closely for over 20 years, and I met him close up a number of times when I was working with Tony Blair. Blair and Putin had a series of meetings early on in Putin's formative time, and most of them are what we call 1+1. Each leader has a +1 to take a note and to chip in when it might be needed. And I was the +1 for Tony Blair at that stage. And so you got to see Putin really close up. And he was a man who'd stabilized Russia after the chaotic 1990s, who actually in his first couple of years was trying to modernize and reform Russia in a sensible direction. I think the Iraq war set back some of those relations, but what really set it back were the Orange Revolutions the colored revolutions in first Georgia and then Ukraine in 2003-2004. And he set himself against reform. And he set himself the goal of rebuilding Russia, but with complete tight control at the center and using the revenues from increasing oil price and oil sales and gas sales in order to fund a state that could deliver some services to the Russian people. And then after 2014 and the crisis in Ukraine then and the collapse of the oil price, it changed from being, the deal used to be, you leave us in power and we'll deliver growing services to you. They couldn't do that after 2014 because of the state of the Russian economy and the global economy. And increasingly, Putin's deal with the Russian people was, you leave us in power and we will restore Russia's greatness. And you could see where that deal came from, but he still pursued it rationally. And the annexation of Crimea was a clinical, cynical, but effective coup de main, a successful operation that he carried out. The President Putin we've been watching in the last few weeks is a different President Putin. I don't know what's happened to him during the 2 years of COVID, except that he's been incredibly isolated, including from his own advisors and his own officials. And he seems to live in an information bubble. I think he's made a massive error of judgment in his own interests, not only in the interests of Ukraine. I think he's miscalculated how the Ukrainian people would react. And now he's facing a situation where his military are facing really concerted resistance. How President Zelensky, to many people's surprise, is providing brave and inspiring leadership to the Ukrainian people. And the weight of sanctions that have been brought to bear on Russia is vastly greater than President Putin and those around him would have expected. So I think we're now in a situation where President Putin is on the back foot. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to lose the war in Ukraine. Brave though the Ukrainian resistance is, the fact is the Russians have got immensely powerful armed forces and will be able to take Kharkiv and Kiev even at the cost of destroying them. And there's that famous quote from an American major in the Vietnam War, we have to destroy the village in order to take it, in order to save it. But one has this horrible sense that even though Kiev is the cradle of Russian civilization, in many ways Putin is right to describe it as that, there's a risk of destroying Kiev in order to occupy it. And that would be, you know, an absolutely terrible outcome for this. But it would be entirely President Putin's fault. This is President Putin's war. It's Putin's war, this. So what am I watching for? I'm watching for how fast the Russians advance inside Ukraine, and there's a mixed picture there. How far they go, how far west they go. The further west they go, the more resistance they will meet, and the greater the risk of a clash on the borders between Russia and NATO countries like Poland, Hungary, Romania, and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm looking to see what the political reaction in Moscow is, and looking to see what the impact of sanctions might be. One of the things I do in my afterlife from public service is I sit on the board of BP, and you will have seen the news over the last couple of days of the big decision we took to exit Russia. Now, some might say, well, why were you there in the first place? Well, we were there in the first place because it was a very good investment to make, and it produced excellent returns for shareholders over 25 years, 23 years or something. But it became impossible to be there. And although it was a costly decision, it wasn't a difficult decision because there was no alternative. And we're seeing Equinor followed yesterday. Shell have just followed this evening. I saw in the news before I came in here. The Russian ruble is collapsing, and the level of opposition in Russia is growing. But that said, I think it's important that we leave a way out for Putin from this crisis. If we trap him in a corner and he feels his whole existence is at threat as leader of the Russian regime, then that is a very dangerous time for us all. We saw him fiddling with nuclear alert levels on Sunday, and that was a warning to us. I think it's really important. This is a dangerous time, a dangerous time across Europe. It's really important this doesn't become a conflict between NATO and Russia, and Putin can't turn it into an issue where it looks as though we are battling against Russia. What we're doing is we're supporting Ukraine in its independence and its self-determination and in its sovereignty. And that's the battleground we have to stay on. And it has to be a battleground which, whilst we support Ukrainian armed forces in their resistance, we do not step across the line and engage Russia directly in conflict, because that would raise the level of tensions and threat vastly higher.
And how effective do you think economic sanctions and discussions with Russia will be in the coming weeks?
Well, I'm not hopeful about the early negotiations. And there's that meeting that took place on the Ukraine-Belarus border today. The Russians sent as their head of delegation an extreme nationalist historian who was there to, I suspect, read the Ukrainians a lecture. I suspect he was the man who influenced President Putin in his essay last July about Ukraine, which some of you may have read. So I don't expect much progress from that. But it's good that Zelensky wants to be able to talk. And although President Macron has sort of positioned himself as a sort of savior of Europe or representative of Europe on this, actually, the fact that he's talking to President Putin, and he spoke again to Putin today, I think that's a good thing that is going on. But the fact is, the Russian demands are for an unconditional surrender of Ukraine, the resignation of the Zelensky government, and Ukrainian recognition of Crimea as being part of Russia. Now, there's absolutely no way that those negotiable demands for a Ukrainian government. And what the West is supporting is the elected Ukrainian government deciding Ukraine's future. Now, there are some issues where there's scope for movement. And the reality is that that whilst Ukraine wants to become a member of NATO, there's no realistic prospect of it becoming a member of NATO. And then can you use that fact in a negotiation with Russia to address one of the Russian concerns? The answer is, I think you probably can with skillful diplomacy, but it is difficult to deploy skillful diplomacy when you've got shells and missiles and tanks, you know, rolling around your capital, and you're under that level of duress. So I think the sanctions, which are at an unprecedented level, we used to save the most extreme financial sanctions for global pariahs like North Korea or Iran when we were trying to get them to give up their nuclear weapons aspirations. And we still are, of course. Thank you, Donald Trump, for messing that one up. These sanctions, the freezing of the central banks of Russia's assets, these are very far-reaching sanctions which are having a direct impact on the Russian economy. You're seeing the stock market has tanked, the ruble has collapsed in value, ordinary Russians can't get money out of their cash machines. This is going to play into reactions on the streets of Moscow and other Russian cities really quite quickly. And so how that plays into the debates, such as they are within the government system, we'll have to watch very closely. And they'll be all behind closed doors. But I think it is important that we allow these pressures to come to bear. As I saw in South Africa, the main sanctions against South Africa started in 1977. It wasn't actually until 12 years later that the process of change began in South Africa, serious change began in South Africa. The real economic pressures started in the mid-80s after the riots and in Soweto and other townships and the brutal suppression of them by the regime. Sanctions take a time. I don't believe anyone thinks that these sanctions by themselves will change Putin's mind. He's not going to say, oh, I can't do this, I now need to withdraw. But they are posing a price. They're affecting perceptions and attitudes inside Russia, amongst the Russian elite. And one of the values of sanctions is that when a leader decides that they do want to negotiate, the easing of those sanctions becomes a motive. One of the big motives in South Africa was allowing rugby teams and cricket teams to play against South Africans. Now, you may not be very interested in sport, but it meant a big thing for a lot of South African males who were otherwise quite resistant to the process of change. In Iran, when I negotiated with Iran in the early years of the nuclear deal, the prospect of easing economic sanctions was massively attractive to the to the Iranians, and still is. That's their main motive for negotiating a return by the Americans to the nuclear deal. So there's a sanctions have a certain effect straight away, but they're not so much a political effect. Their political effect comes later, once their real impact has sunk in, and the economies and lifestyles of the leadership, ideally, rather than the people of the country. But they're a pretty blunt instrument, I'm afraid, sanctions. But they do have an effect. And I've witnessed in South Africa, in Serbia, in the Balkans wars, in Libya over their weapons of mass destruction, in Iran over their nuclear program. And to some extent, China adjusts its response in order to minimize sanctions or to avert sanctions. So sanctions can be an important weapon, but they're blunt and they're slow in effect.
And do you think the UK could have done more to prevent the escalation of the current crisis?
I think President Putin was set on this for some months. I wouldn't have said that a month ago, because I thought that it was still possible that he could have used this force that he gathered around Ukraine's borders for coercive diplomacy, to extract concessions from Ukraine, extract concessions from the West, force Ukraine down a path that was more amenable to Russian interests. But the harsh reality is, looking back on Putin's actions of the last 2 weeks or so, was that he had this in mind all along. And I there perhaps might have been more that we could have done to prepare for it, to help prepare the Ukrainians for it. But I don't think, even a week before the invasion began, President Zelensky and his government were urging the Americans to calm the temperature. No, this isn't going to happen. We need to keep things as normal as possible. And to the government's credit, it has done well to provide defense aid, lethal material to the Ukrainian armed forces to help them defend themselves. I'm sure some of those Russian tanks that are lying in the gutter of Ukraine's roads are there because of some of the weapons that have been provided to the Ukrainian forces over the last period. And I think the global sanctions effort, I think, has surprised everybody. And initially, and most of you won't understand, and I don't really understand how the international financial trading system works, but this SWIFT mechanism in Brussels, where it's a messaging system for clearing financial transactions, there was an agreement between the EU and the US just to leave that alone, just let the Russians do some basic business through the SWIFT mechanism in order so that Germany could pay for its gas and that you could do the bare minimum. But it quickly became a sort of touchstone as to whether your sanctions were serious enough. And excluding Russian banks from the SWIFT mechanism, freezing the central bank's assets, have had this massive impact. I'm sure the Chinese are watching this very carefully indeed, this new generation of sanctions that are being introduced now.
Well, I'm keen to leave some time for audience questions. If you have a question, if you could raise your membership card, and we will come round with a microphone.
Raise your membership card. There's a challenge.
Well, and the member just at the front here in black puffer.
Obviously, you've said that it's very important that this doesn't become a battle directly between NATO and Russia. But do you think it is appropriate and that there is room for some more clandestine operations directly in support of Ukraine? Obviously, we have MI6, we have offensive cyber capabilities within the intelligence community. Do you think there is space to deploy those without it escalating further to better support openly Ukraine?
Well, that's a brilliant question, and you've got a future in the security services. But it's the sort of question which obviously I find very difficult to answer. And I hope you understand the reasons for that. I think it's really important that, as I said in my earlier remarks, we don't allow President Putin to present this as the West trying to topple his regime, because that then becomes an existential question for Russia. And some of the things you're implying, we get pretty damn close to that. The one thing about clandestine operations is they always become known at some point. So you can't keep things clandestine forever. And the second thing I would say is, yes, there are a variety of things that we can do to support the extraordinary bravery of the Ukrainians at human level, military, at the leadership level, as they go through this. And I think a lot of the things that we're doing is very much supportive of that. But President Putin, in one of his interviews, tells quite a revealing story about his own childhood, about how he lived in a block of a ghastly block of flats in one of the poorer areas of Leningrad, as it was then, St. Petersburg, as it is now. And he used to chase rats around the stairwell. And one day, he got a rat, and he got it in a corner. Now, it may have been invented, this story, but this is the story he tells. He got a rat in the corner, and he trapped it. And the next thing he knew, the rat had flown out and hit him in the face, scratched him, and escaped. And his lesson was, never corner a rat. Well, I don't know if he was referring to himself, but there's a certain lesson in there for us, that if you corner someone who's incredibly dangerous, somewhat irrational, and has got nuclear weapons at the end of his fingertips, we need to be a little bit careful how we do that. So we must leave Putin a way out of this in due course, so that we mustn't allow him to think that this is an existential system, existential crisis for his regime. That's a matter for Russians to sort out. It's not a matter for us to determine those issues. What we can do to support the Ukrainians, there'll be a spectrum of things that we can do. I'm not going to get into the realm of speculating on the things that you were talking about. But clearly the whole spirit, the morale of the sentiment of the British people, the British government, strongly behind the Ukrainian people, and rightly so. And that's where our commitment will lie.
And I'll take a question from the member just in the yellow at the back.
Can you stand up so we can see you?
Hi, good evening. You mentioned that sanctions are primarily a tool of politics and negotiations whose effects are seen at a later date. And you also told us the tale of how one mustn't corner a rat. With this in mind, hypothetically, what do you think the next step is should Putin increase or continue his march into Ukraine? And following that, what do you think of China's current position as well?
Well, I think the Russian forces will continue their march into Ukraine. They are vastly outnumber Ukrainian forces. They've got heavy artillery, which I think we will see more of. And there are reports of, there are reports of low morale and motivation amongst a lot of the Russian conscripts who are doing this fighting. But there's also disturbing rumours that Chechen irregulars are being brought in to do the dirty work that Russian troops might balk at. So I think we do need to brace ourselves for further violence in Ukraine. And ultimately, I think most military analysts would say we should expect the Russian forces to prevail. But they will be having to occupy a country which is almost united in opposition to what the Russians are doing and will put up a very severe fight. President Putin has used some rather, to us, astonishing language, accusing Ukrainians of being Nazis, and he wants to denazify Ukraine. I think he's remembering a distorted version of what happened after World War II, in that after the and the Ukrainians, a bit like the Finns in this regard, they were faced with two evils. They had the Germans on one hand and they had the Russians on the other hand, and it wasn't clear which side was a bigger danger to their long-term national struggle. But after 1945, it was very clear to Ukrainians that the bigger opposition came, bigger obstacle was the Russians, the Soviets. And there was a civil war in the west of what is now the west of Ukraine for their independence, in which about 100,000 people were killed as the Ukrainians fought against the Soviets. And because some of them had worked with the Nazis as well, the Russians accused all of them of being Nazis. Actually, they were Ukrainian nationalists. So there's a history here, but it's a distorted history that President Putin is recalling. I expect there to be I think it's reasonable to expect that after a bloody war, which will last several weeks yet, the Russian armed forces will prevail, but that there will be a sustained opposition and insurgency by Ukrainians against that Russian occupation. I hope it doesn't. I hope Ukrainians stand their ground, but I think it would be wishful thinking to think that they're going to be able to prevent the Russians imposing themselves on certain Ukrainian cities and basically forcing the ousting of the Zelensky government from Kiev. So that would be my expectation. But in wars, you know, they never go as planned. You can never predict how they're going to run their course. And politics back home can change what happens on the battlefield. There is that. There are those complications. Should I take the China question now?
Yes, please.
I think this is very interesting, the China dimension. and this is awkward for China, because by far the biggest issue in the world for China is their rivalry, strategic rivalry with the United States. And Russia is a sort of is a useful partner to China in that endeavor. And they face some of the same challenges. They want to close down freedom of information, both China and Russia. They want to make themselves less susceptible to financial pressure and the power of the dollar. And they want to be able to run their autocratic systems without being constantly hectored about their appalling human rights performances. And so China and Russia have got a number of sort of common interests in here. But China also firmly believes in national sovereignty, territorial integrity, and not intervening violently in another country next door to you. And they do that for their own purposes. They don't want anyone claiming Tibet is independent or preventing them in due course trying to reintegrate Taiwan with the mainland, to govern their views on Hong Kong as well for the last 50 years before and after the handover. So the Chinese have got strong views on those principles, and they want to protect them as well. I used to deal with the Chinese a lot when I was in the Security Council. Obviously, the Chinese were one of the P5. And you several times felt them to be sort of rolling their eyes at what the Russians were doing, because the Chinese were much more skillful, much more thoughtful, and were longer term, and were less brutal. I think the Chinese leadership, they look back at the Brezhnev era and they see a failure to modernize and rejuvenate the Communist Party, which led to its demise. They see the way President Gorbachev tried to bring in economic reform and political reform at the same time and failed. Because it led to the collapse of the system. And I think they might now be looking at President Putin and thinking, here's a third Russian leader making a mistake of strategic proportions, and they will be studying what's happening on the battlefield. They'll be studying carefully this new generation of sanctions that they do not want to get caught up in or be subject to. And if there's one silver lining to the cloud of what's happening in Ukraine, I think those people who worry about a Chinese attack on an invasion of Taiwan, I think that's even less likely now in the near future than it was before. And we can go into more China discussion if any of you want to do that. But I think the Chinese will be following this very carefully. They'll be a bit embarrassed by what the Russians are doing. But the biggest issue for them will be the ongoing prosecution of their competition and rivalry with the United States.
We have time for one more very brief question. I'll take it from the member at the back just here.
Usually end these things on a light-hearted note, but it's quite hard to do that on an occasion like this.
Hello. Thank you for your speech. It's very, very good. So as someone who's built an esteemed career on information and intelligence, I'm curious, well, how do you get your news?
That's an interesting point, because I stepped down from MI6 and from the government at the end of 2014, and I did wonder what I would do without the flow of intelligence reports and diplomatic cables and privileged meetings with counterparts and leaders from other countries who would beat a path to the MI6 door. But actually, I found that a lot of the information that I was getting at that time is incredibly detailed. And I used to talk about Syria earlier. I used to know every damn village in Syria and all the terrorist units and the different areas where they were operating. Sort of information which, frankly, now is not a great help. There is a fantastic range of open source material. During COVID, one of the benefits of COVID was that instead of traveling to America or traveling to Singapore or traveling to Berlin or whatever, I could attend a meeting in Singapore in the morning, meeting in Berlin at lunchtime, a meeting in London at tea time. At 9 o'clock at night, I'd attend something in New York or San Francisco. And it was a fantastic liberation in that sense, in that my network that I built up over the years, many of whom are my own generation, so we're sort of beyond government now, but we could communicate and learn from younger people who are still in government. And people are interested. I do a number of advisory. I have a number of advisory roles, helping people understand the world in which they're operating, the tough business decisions they have to take, how they deal with their investments in China, how they manage Saudi Arabia. Bliss will not talk about Saudi Arabia in a gathering like this. What I do is obviously, you read the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the Economist and various other things every day and every week. You keep your network of communications, and you have, in my case, over 40 years experience of operating in this world and being able to build on that. So I feel I've got a privileged starting point. If someone wants to talk about Kashmir, well, I haven't thought about Kashmir for a long time, but I do remember negotiations on Kashmir between the Indians and the Pakistanis, and I can clock back into that. I know where the starting point is of the Indians and the Pakistanis when they start negotiating on that. And that is true of a lot of very long-standing conflicts like Cyprus or Ethiopia and other parts of the world, Middle East. And it also means that you can get your head around new conflicts really quite quickly, because you know how governments respond, you know how politics change, you know the uncertainty of the battlefield, and you have some experience. We're talking about sanctions. I've dealt with sanctions all my life in different